1946 was the year after World War II ended. London was still, you know, in ruins from all the bombing during World War II. But 1946 was the last year before Britain started dismantling its empire. And it's interesting to hear the perception here. Now, one thing I want to draw your attention to is that political correctness has totally changed the way we look at everything. There's a very good book on this by a man called Peter Hitchens, H-I-T-C-H-E-N-S, who is an English writer who originally was a socialist, in fact, I think even a communist, but he's now very conservative. So he's changed his thinking considerably. And he wrote a book a few years ago called The Abolition of Britain. And the points he brings out are equally applicable to the United States, even though he's writing about Britain. But what he does is he contrasts Britain at the time of Winston Churchill's funeral in January 1965, and I still remember that, with Britain at the time of Princess Diana's funeral in 1997, and shows a country that had totally changed in that 32-year period. Now, there's a book that has come out in the United States. I haven't read it, but I saw it advertised recently, called 1964, The Year That Changed Everything. And the premise is basically the same. You see, the 1960s was the decade that changed everything. With the British Empire, before 1960, people believed the British Empire was a good thing. With the 1960s and political correctness, people believed it's a bad thing. It's a bad thing for one nation to rule over other nations. Even though the reality is that the people who lived in the British Empire were freer than they are today, now that their countries are supposedly free. But since their countries became free, they have mostly become dictatorships. And certainly most of them, the people in most of them, have experienced a declining standard of living. In Ghana, for example, where I lived for many years in West Africa, before independence from Britain in 1957, the people in Ghana were the best educated in Africa. Ghana was the most prosperous of all Britain's African colonies, so it got independence first. The per capita income, that's the average income of the people, was higher than in some European countries. In Portugal, for example, and some countries in the East, like all the communist countries, the Ghanaians lived better than all the people in those nations. And they certainly were freer. They had a very lively free press. You could write anything or say anything that you wanted to say. Now, of course, it's changed completely. Ghanaians today, their average income is $30 a month. South Korea and Ghana were on a par at the end of the Korean War. In 1965, I should say, they were on a par. I read this recently. And now South Koreans earn something like 20 or 30 times as much as Ghanaians do. So you see the difference. It's just incredible, the difference. Remember the prophecy said in Genesis 12, God said that Abraham's descendants would be a blessing to the world, a physical blessing as well as a spiritual blessing, the blessing coming through Jesus Christ, the spiritual blessing. Now, this is the perception of an American company making this travelogue in 1946. Now, I use this because Americans historically have tended to have a negative view of colonialism. But listen to what this commentary says, just for a few minutes, okay? And turn the light out, if you like.
Rise the spirit of the new light that is now filtering into London. This grand old edifice, standing like something resurrected from the dead, is a symbol of the resurrection that is destined to come to all the buildings of London that were destroyed by war. But we feel that no modern construction will be able to surpass this architectural wonder, which is probably the outstanding landmark of the British Empire. Within its sacred tombs lie buried many of the illustrious dead of Britain, but it is to the living that St. Paul's now offers greatest consolation, hope and faith in things that are here and greater things that are destined to come. The regal pomp of yesterday has returned to London with all its colorful tradition, and the Lord Mayor on this occasion is host to the first British expeditionary force that distinguished itself in the War of 1914, at which time these men made such an impression on the Kaiser during the Battle of the Marne
that he referred to them as contemptible, and they have proudly kept the name ever since. Such is the spirit that is British. And now let us go for a ride down Piccadilly, where life has taken on a post-war feeling, and the whirl of old London is beginning to assert itself again. Here in Piccadilly Circus, the hub of the British Empire, one may find a conglomeration of peoples representing every color, creed, and nationality in the world. During the war, millions of Allied soldiers passed this way, en route to and from the battlefronts of the world. And while in transit, they presented a spectacle that will never be forgotten in the annals of old Piccadilly. And when the sun shines in Piccadilly, a little touch of the spirit of Paris intrudes itself, foreign and unusual. Getting back to the traditional, we are inspired by the significance of this institution in which the Houses of Parliament meet. It covers 8 acres, has 1,100 rooms, 100 staircases, and 2 miles of passages. Aside from material proportions, however, we are most impressed by the fact that this is the seat of the supreme government of the British Empire, the mother of parliaments and free nations, elected by universal suffrage. The model for the whole world of representative institutions, the last word in democracy. And while we're on the subject of democracy, it is fitting that we should turn our attention now to a solitary monument that stands within the shadow of the Houses of Parliament and also symbolizes Britain's appreciation for the champions of democracy in all countries. Abraham Lincoln, the American rail splitter, who brought freedom to 3 million slaves. The great Tower of London, dating back through 9 centuries to the days of William the Conqueror, is another survivor of the war. In conclusion, we rejoice that most of the cherished old landmarks and institutions of London have escaped the horrors of war, for without them, the civilized world would be deprived of a priceless heritage. And it is with this thought that we now conclude our impressions of post-war London.
Now, while we have the tape changed here, I'll just bring to your attention a couple of things that were in there. Again, this is from an outside point of view. The commentary, the production is from outside of the British Empire. And the Empire was perceived as an association of free nations. And the Parliament building that you saw was the mother of parliaments and parliamentary democracy and freedom around the world. And that was the perception in 1946, okay? Now, as I said, political correctness has changed that. The thinking has changed. Peter Hitchens, in his book, The Abolition of Britain, shows that right up until Churchill died in January 1965, this was the perception that people had. But then PC took over, and we've had this political correctness pushed down our throats for over 30 years, almost 40 years now, to the point where people can't think straight anymore. And that is true on both sides of the Atlantic. In fact, it's true throughout the Western world. But up until Churchill died, people basically believed the empire was a good thing. They were very patriotic. Americans also felt that way. And people believed that the family structure, as God gave it to us in the book of Genesis, is the one that we should have. Of course, now everything's been turned upside down. Now, all of this ties in with some of the scriptures we're going to look at today, too. But let's have the next film first before we do that. Now, this film is a film of the coronation of the present queen, which was June the 2nd, 1953. Now, I was born between that film and the other film, although I was too young to remember the coronation. I think I was 2 and a half when the coronation took place. But you'll see, when you see this extract from the coronation, the queen is crowned as queen of a number of different countries. Remember, the Commonwealth countries, those are the countries that are named. The Commonwealth were countries that are completely independent, but the Queen was still Queen of each of these countries, and they were a combined military force, and it was a very powerful military force. It was the world superpower before the United States. Now, in addition to the Commonwealth countries, were all the countries that were a part of the Empire, the colonies that Britain still ruled. And they had their own parliaments as well, but they were not independent. And so the British Empire was still a major force at the time of the coronation, in June of 1953. 4 years later, it was not a major force. That's how quickly it unraveled. And that's the lesson that I want to look at today, so we can understand it as Americans and see the analogies with our situation today, okay? Because there are some very distinct similarities between the situation of Britain in 1953 and the United States today in the year 2004. So just have a look at this brief extract. There are two extracts I want to show you from the coronation film. By the way, just as an aside, this film of the coronation is only available in the United States. You can't buy it anywhere in the British Commonwealth. Go figure. Let me read again the quote from James Truslow Adams, the American historian, who wrote this in 1940 about the British Empire. Remember, at that time in 1940, the British Empire was faced with a Nazi invasion of Britain itself. If Britain had fallen to the Nazis, then the whole empire would have fallen to the Nazis. Now, America would have had to have acted very quickly to make sure Canada did not become a part of Nazi Germany, but America would have been isolated totally, and the United States would have had to sue for peace with Hitler on Hitler's terms. That's what would have happened. And, you know, we forget that. So a great deal depended on this little island and what was called the Battle of Britain, which is when every single plane in the Royal Air Force was in the skies every night fighting to stop the German Luftwaffe from defeating Britain. And there were 5 nights in particular, 5 days in May, when it seemed as if Britain would fall. And, you know, the pilots at that time had a life expectancy of something like 3 weeks, that's all. And they were guys who were 18, 19, 20, 21 years of age. But the whole future of the world depended upon this battle, the Battle of Britain. And there were lots of books and even movies on this, okay? James Truslow Adams wrote this in the middle of that. The possible overthrow of the British Empire would be a catastrophe scarcely thinkable. Not only would it leave a vacuum over a quarter of the globe, into which all the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression would rush, but the strongest bulwark outside ourselves for our own safety and freedom would have been destroyed. Now remember what I showed yesterday, a key to understanding where we are in prophecy is Genesis 49 verse 22, where in telling his sons what would befall them in the latter days, Jacob uses the term Joseph rather than Ephraim or Manasseh. So he's looking at Joseph as one at the time of the end. So to understand where we are right now, you've got to factor in, you've got to look at the British Empire as well as the United States, because the world has been dominated by the tribe of Joseph for a couple of hundred years, okay? This prediction from James Truslow Adams shows the world would be in a state of chaos with the fall of the British Empire. And that has been the period in which I have lived, because that is what I've seen. As the British Empire collapsed, so the wild winds of anarchy, despotism, and spiritual oppression have rushed in to the various countries that Britain used to rule. And that is why we have many of the problems we have. That is also, incidentally, why September the 11th took place. And I will show you later on. Okay? Well, let's have a look at this extract now.
Madam, is Your Majesty willing to take the oath? Will you solemnly promise and swear to govern the people of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Union of South Africa, Pakistan, and Ceylon, and of your possessions and the other territories to any of them belonging or pertaining, according to their respective laws and customs.
I solemnly promise so to do.
Will you, to your power, cause law and justice in mercy to be executed in all your judgments?
I will.
Will you, to the utmost of your power, maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel? Will you, to the utmost of your power, maintain in the United Kingdom the Protestant Reformed religion established by law? Will you maintain and preserve inviolable the settlement of the Church of England and the doctrine, worship, discipline, and government thereof as by law established in England? And will you preserve unto the bishops and clergy of England and to the churches there committed to their charge all such rights and privileges as by law do or shall appertain to them or any of them?
All that I promise to do.
All right, you can stop it there and moving on to the next point. Okay, things to notice there are, again, the multitude of nations was still intact as late as 1953. Notice also in the oath that the Queen took, the commitment to uphold the laws of God, and also the Protestant religion as the established religion of Great Britain. The reason for that is because, historically, of the threat of invasion from Roman Catholicism. The law in Britain is that the monarch must be a Protestant. In fact, she is the head of the Church of England. And also, the Protestant religion, remember, gave Britain the Bible. Roman Catholicism did not allow the Bible. And you had this commitment to the Bible and the laws of God. And, you know, the Church of England throughout the last few centuries has been very committed to the laws of God until recently. Obviously, they had the Sabbath wrong. They had the wrong day when it came to the Sabbath. But when it came to the other laws, not just Britain, but also Australia, New Zealand, and so on, and the United States, too, we have historically had a commitment to the Ten Commandments as understood. Again, the fourth commandment has not been understood properly. Yes, question.
Yes, is the Bible used in any connection in that ceremony such as we do here? I couldn't really tell from looking
at the picture. Is the Bible used in the ceremony?
Such as we do here with the president.
Oh, yes, yes.
Is that what's sitting in front of her?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. When the United States was formed as a country, some of these things were adapted and carried on. So yes, very much. The Bible was looked upon as the foundation of our countries. Aaron.
Wasn't there the rack of Jacob under the chair?
The Jacob's pillar stone is under the chair, yes. That is, it might be difficult to prove that it was Jacob's pillar stone, but legend has it that it is Jacob's pillar stone, and it's the coronation stone above which monarchs are crowned. It was captured from the Scots in 1296. Don't believe what you see in Mel Gibson's movie, Braveheart. Braveheart isn't 100% accurate. And in fact, The Patriot isn't even 50% accurate. So hopefully The Passion, which comes out today, might be more accurate, but I wouldn't count on it. But anyway, the coronation stone was taken from Scotland in 1296. And monarchs had been crowned on it for the past few centuries. It was returned to Scotland on the 700th anniversary in 1996 with the agreement that whenever a monarch is crowned, it will be returned to London for the coronation itself. So if you want to see it now, you have to go to Edinburgh Castle, okay? All right, we ready? Let's go ahead with this. I want you to note all the prime ministers of the different independent countries within the empire as they leave the abbey. This is Westminster Abbey that was built in 1042, almost 1,000 years old, or at least part of it was, not the whole thing. This is probably the most impressive ceremony on earth, the coronation of a British monarch.
service is at an end. The prime ministers leave the Abbey. The prime ministers of Northern Ireland, of Southern Rhodesia, of Ceylon, of Pakistan, of India, of South Africa, of New Zealand, of Australia, and of Canada. And the Right Honorable Sir Winston Churchill, who has said of the Queen, "The lady whom we respect because she is our Queen, and whom we love because she is herself." The Duke of Edinburgh leaves, followed by his page, Midshipman Rees, RN, and the members of His Royal Highness's suite. Edward the Confessor returns to pass in procession through the choir and the nave, and so out of the abbey into the London which waits to receive her.
I want you to see the troops from the various parts of the multitude of nations, the Commonwealth, the Empire, which you'll see in a moment, okay? One reason why everybody moves so slow is that crown weighs 32 pounds. And the Queen had a splitting headache all day. She's a very short woman. Normally it's worn by a man, of course, but 32 pounds is a heavy weight to carry on your head. I'm sorry? You'll have to ask me, I can't hear you. But we can turn it down, actually, because we can talk while you're watching the rest. Go ahead, Lindsay. Oh, I don't know how much those weigh. They've never let me hold them.
They let you hold the crown.
You can see the crown. You go to the if you go to the Tower of London, to the crown, there's the jewel house, it's called. You can see all the crown jewels in there. Although when I was there in August, the imperial state crown, which is the Queen's crown, that one she's wearing there, could not be seen because they do have to use it sometimes. When she opens Parliament, for example, it is used. Yes, Josh, you have a question?
Yeah, I got two quick ones.
Yeah, go ahead.
One, how much would that crown, like pure gold and like diamonds?
Yeah. Well, you see, the various countries had a part in it. I mean, the big diamond in there, which is, you know, priceless, was given by the South Africans because she was Queen of South Africa. You know, the basic cost is met by the British government, but I mean, you can't possibly put a price on it. The crown jewels are not insured because nobody would insure them. Well, the relationship has changed. You know, with the Queen is still Queen of 17 different countries. She is also head of the Commonwealth, which is 54 countries. So she still has a major role to play, but not as much as it was back then. But I will show that as we go through the rest of today. Lindsay, you had a...
Is that the Queen Mother?
The Queen Mother was there, yes. Yes. See, she was the wife of the King, George VI, who died the year before the coronation. It takes almost 18 months to prepare a coronation because you've got all the prime ministers of all the Commonwealth countries that have to come, and you've got all the physical preparations. All the members of the royal family must be there, various dignitaries from around the world, and, you know, for that reason, you've got to get a date, which means considerably ahead, when everybody can be there. And they also pick the day when the weather forecasters said it would be the best day, statistically, you know, from recent years. That was the best day for the weather. And guess what? It rained all day. Yeah. Right. Well, 2 years ago was the Golden Jubilee. She became Queen in February 1952. The coronation was June 53. But the 50th anniversary was 2 years ago, the Golden Jubilee. Queen Victoria was queen for 64 years. I think Elizabeth II will live as long, looking at things. Okay, turn it up a little bit for all the... You see the troops of the different nations that formed the multitude of nations at this time. British military power in 1953 was four times greater than it is now. Remember, I said yesterday that during the British Empire, a third of British troops were Indians. India included at that time Pakistan and Bangladesh, they were all a part of the Indian Empire. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The mount is still, on a rotation basis, protect the Queen in London. They form the guard outside Buckingham Palace once every 3 years, as do other troops from various countries. Now, here's the Queen Mother leaving the Abbey. She died, 2 years ago, or last year, I don't remember, aged 101, I think, when she died.
In a swing of tartan, pipers from Scotland and Ireland.
If you could just turn it down so I can speak. You don't have to turn it down completely so people can hear it still. Because at the end, I'll just leave it on for you while I'm talking. But at the end, you'll see the fly pass. And it's, you know, incredible as the planes come over Buckingham Palace. But you also see them spell out information, E2R, which is the symbol of Elizabeth II. If you look at British mailboxes, for example, they all have the Royal Coat of Arms. And it's an ER with the Roman numerals 2 in the middle. And that's how all official papers are and everything. And the planes form this formation over Buckingham Palace. So I'll leave it on for you to see that. But you'll also see, I mean, the just never-ending forces that came by. And this is only a small percentage of the forces that the British Empire still had at this time. And remember, by 1953, Britain was no longer... the preeminent power. The United States had replaced Britain as the number one power. Now, just to go back a little bit further, in 1939, which was the year World War II started, in 1939, the Queen's father, King George VI, with his wife, who we call the Queen Mother, but she was just on the picture, they visited the United States and Canada. For those of you who've been to Niagara Falls, you'll go on the QEW, the Queen Elizabeth Way, which is the main road to Niagara Falls. That was opened by the Queen Mother in 1939 and named after her. But when the King and Queen came to Washington, they stayed at the White House. And Franklin Roosevelt said to the King in 1939, he said, "Remember, you are our first line of defense." Which is exactly what James Truslow Adams says here. He uses the expression, he describes the British Empire as the strongest bulwark outside ourselves for our own safety and freedom. The British Empire was America's first line of defense right up until World War II. All the way through the 1800s, America issued the Monroe Doctrine, which told foreign powers to stay out of the Americas. It was the British Royal Navy that enforced the Monroe Doctrine all the way through the 19th century. Because it was also in... Oh, this is Queen Salotti of Tonga, who was a very big lady. And that's Sir Winston Churchill, who was the Prime Minister at that time. Josh? A US one? I don't think so. Possibly. I'm not sure who represented the U.S. at that time, either. That's the Queen's sister, Princess Margaret, who died a few years ago.
Following the glass coach of the Queen Mother and Princess Margaret comes Her Majesty's own physician, Captain...
Now, the year after this, 1954, the Queen and her husband went on a tour of the British Empire. And, you know, in Australia, for example, I mean, they were mobbed by 500,000-plus people as soon as they arrived. And, you know, the people still have this intense loyalty, not just to the Queen herself, but to the whole concept of empire and commonwealth. But by 1957, it was over. Now, there's some sobering lessons there, okay? And that's what we want to look at now. But I want to just go back a little bit further, okay? On the eve of World War I, in 1913, World War I started in 1914, in 1913, it was the 300th anniversary of the Romanov dynasty in Russia. And the Tsar and his wife, Nicholas II, and the Empress Alexandra, Alex, spelled like A-L-I-X, okay? Nicholas and Alexandra went on a tour of their empire. And everywhere they went, they were extremely popular. And Lenin, who was the leader of the Bolshevik Party, who later seized power and began the communist rule of Russia, Lenin in 1913 wrote to his wife, who was in Switzerland, and said the revolution will never take place in our lifetimes because the Tsar and his wife are just so popular. 4 years later, the whole thing had collapsed. The same with Germany. In 1914, when war began, the Kaiser, Wilhelm II, was extremely popular. Again, you have film of, you know, people outside the palace in Potsdam. And, you know, everybody just thought this, he was a great guy. And again, you know, this was on the eve of World War I. The same in Austria-Hungary, where Franz Joseph, who was the emperor of Austria-Hungary, was a very popular monarch and the longest-serving monarch in history. He reigned for 68 years. Within 4 years, it was all gone. So how can nations at the pinnacle of their power, Germany, for example, in the first decade of the 20th century, was one of the fastest growing economies in the world. You know, how could all of this collapse so quickly? There is a commonality that you see in the fall of nations, especially in the last 500 years. One book I might refer you to here is Paul Kennedy's book, which is really a masterpiece on this subject. And I believe one of the most important books you can read on this, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. It was written, I believe, in 1988 was when it was published. So it was published before the fall of communism. So he does talk a bit about the signs that the Soviet Union is going to fall apart. But he also brings out in the book reasons why American preeminence is also going to end. The signs were there in 1988. The signs are even more there now. And I know it is possible to sit out there thinking, well, if people have been saying this since 1988, it's been 16 years, obviously they're wrong. It's not that simple. When did this start to decline? Anybody like to guess? This is 1953, the coronation, the multitude of nations is still intact. But when did it start to decline? Aaron. Nope, not 1964. By then it was all over, well and truly. Tyler. No? You could make a good case to say 1914. I mean, this is arbitrary. Understand that, because decline is a gradual thing. So, you know, whatever date you take, you can look at certain signs. You could go back a little bit further. Anybody else would like to guess? 1914 was an important year because that was the year World War I started. And World War I changed the world significantly. I would go back even further to about 1870, when Britain's industrial lead started to decline relative to Germany and the United States. But Britain was still the preeminent power well into the 20th century. The biggest single turning point, I think, in when you look at history, would be 1916, so very close to 1914. World War I cost Britain a great deal of money and a lot of men. Britain alone lost 1 million men in World War I. Other countries lost more. And of course, for every one killed, there's a lot more who are injured and handicapped as a result of the fighting. In 1916, something of significance happened. In fact, I think two things of significance in 1916. Anybody like to guess? Nathan? Exactly. Britain had to start borrowing money from the United States, or even more specifically, J.P. Morgan, to be exact. Yes? Secondly? That was the main one, actually. In 1916, Britain had to borrow money from the U.S. to carry on fighting the war. The second one was the Irish revolted in 1916. Not of any great significance, because the Irish are always revolting. I'm sorry if anybody here is of Irish descent, but go to a pub in Ireland on a Saturday night and you'll see what I mean. Anyway, but that was 1916, okay? But the most significant thing, I think, was that Britain had to borrow money from the U.S. When you start borrowing money, you're losing your preeminence. Now, after World War I, the United States, if it had wanted to, could have been the preeminent power. But if you remember, when Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States, Congress would not support his desire to join the League of Nations that was formed after World War I, and America retreated into isolation. So the British Empire continued as the major force in the world. And the British Empire was still intact after World War I, whereas the other empires, the Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, had all collapsed at the end of World War I. So the British and the French empires remained intact. But then World War II really, caused the British Empire to again be weakened because of the cost of fighting the war. Now, the most significant turning point in World War II was the fall of Singapore. I'm giving you a brief history lesson here. In 1942, the biggest British military base in the world outside of Britain fell to the Japanese in 1942. This was in Singapore, very big British naval base. The British had the base heavily defended with all the guns pointing outwards in case they were attacked, from the sea. Nobody thought of defending the rear end because behind them was Malaya, which was a thick jungle, and it was ruled by Britain, so there was no threat. But the Japanese came down through the jungle on their bicycles and hacked their way through the jungle and attacked Singapore and won. And even though Britain had more troops there than the Japanese had. Now, psychologically, this had a major impact on the whole region, throughout the whole of Asia, because for the first time, the preeminent power, Great Britain, had been defeated by a nation that most people considered inferior. That was the perception at the time, that the Asian peoples were inferior to the European peoples, and especially the British, who, you know, were the top dogs, so to speak. So the perception in the minds of people changed as a result of the fall of Singapore, a major turning point. But Britain, together with the United States, the Soviet Union, won World War II. And at the end of World War II, the British Empire was intact. But because of the fall of Singapore, you had peoples in India clamoring for independence. Some of them had already been clamoring before 1942, but once they perceived a British weakness, then the clamor for independence got greater. Now, it probably was only a minority who was stirring up trouble. But at the end of World War II, the British had a major election, and Winston Churchill lost office and was replaced by the Labour Party under Clement Attlee. The Labour Party in Britain was committed to giving everybody a free medical service, to nationalizing the railways, the coal mines, the steel mills. It was a very socialist administration. The British people were tired of fighting wars. They'd been fighting wars all over the world for three or four centuries. And the general feeling was they were sick and tired of fighting wars. Let's bring the boys home and let's have a paradise at home. Let's spend all the money at home. And so there was a major shift in the thinking of the British people. And the British Prime Minister decided to give India independence. And India was divided between the Hindu India, Muslim Pakistan, part of Pakistan later on became Bangladesh. And of course that's led to problems in that part of the world, because today India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons and could destroy, you know, everybody if they have a conflict, and they are constantly in a state of conflict. But to concentrate on Britain, you know, after independence for India, you still had this. India, Pakistan remained in the Commonwealth. It was still a major military force in 1953. In 1954, when the Queen toured the Empire, still the loyalty was there, still the perception of the people was that this was a third force. That's the way they looked upon themselves after World War II. The United States was, you know, one force, the Soviet Union was another, the British Empire was a third force. That's how it was perceived at that particular time, okay? Now, what changed everything was 1956. Does anybody know what happened in 1956? I knew you'd put your hand up, Nathan. Go ahead. All right, I don't know whether you all heard that, so let me repeat what Nathan said. Nathan was correct, okay? And in fact, really, in order to explain this, we really need to look at the map, so we're going to have to finish this. The fly pass should be pretty quick. Do you all know where the Suez Canal is? The Suez Canal, you know, is right there in Egypt, okay? The British built the Suez Canal in the middle of the 1800s, or rather they financed it. I shouldn't say built it. Yeah, go ahead. It was a major world crisis in 1956, but you know, what happened was, as Nathan said, let's go back a little bit. 1952, Egypt had a coup, a new government came to power, and Nasser became the leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was an Arab nationalist who wanted to drive the Europeans out of the Middle East. And in 1956, he seized the Suez Canal, he nationalized it. Now, the Suez Canal was owned primarily by Britain. The French also had a percentage share in it. And it was considered a lifeline of the British Empire, an artery of empire, that expressions like that were used. It was a sea gate. And remember, God had promised that Abraham's descendants would be blessed with these sea gates. You shall possess the gate of your enemies. And Britain had the Suez Canal at that time. And so the British and the French, together with the Israelis, invaded Egypt to take back the Suez Canal. Now, the Israelis had a problem with Gamal Abdel Nasser for different reasons. The French had a problem with him because he was stirring up trouble in Algeria, which was a French colony in North Africa, and he was trying to foment rebellion there. So they all invaded, and they actually won. The military forces actually won and took back the canal. But then, to everybody's surprise, President Eisenhower told the British, the French, and the Israelis to get out. Now, this was a shock. The rest of his cabinet did not agree with his decision. If you look back at cabinet papers from that particular time. But Eisenhower felt that there was a danger of the Russians getting involved, and he wanted the British, the French, and the Israelis out. And when there was a hesitation, Eisenhower threatened the British with economic reprisals, which would have effectively, you can watch this, but these are the planes, it would have effectively brought down the British currency. Now look at this, and then I'll explain this a little bit more, okay? Because again, we have lessons for the United States here. Did you see the planes? Did they form the ER? Not yet? All right, in a moment then. You can get 2 million people out there, by the way, in front of Buckingham Palace on these occasions. By the way, just as an aside, at the coronation, there was one armed policeman with the Queen. When Prince Charles and his wife, Princess Diana, were married in 1981, there were 20,000 armed policemen. You see how the world changed? 28 years? Is a maximum of 5, term of a government. There must be an election at least once every 5 years. But the Prime Minister can, if he wants to, call an election any time. Yeah, another question.
For each man is God's touch to every
man. Only had that one armed one, was it none of the blockies ever carried any kind of weapon?
Yet who the neighbor?
Correct. The police historically in Britain have not carried weapons. A third of the police in London now are trained to carry weapons, but they don't carry weapons without, they have to get the approval of a magistrate to carry weapons. The British people are against the police carrying weapons. No, he has to have an election by 2006, I think, but it's more likely to be next year. The Prime Minister has an advantage in an election because he can choose to have an election before the 5 years is up. So if the government is doing well and is popular, then he can call an election and get another term, you see. If he knows a big problem is going to come up next year, he could call an election tomorrow and win it. So there is an advantage there. Most countries have a fairly flexible election time. The U.S. is different in having a fixed election time.
Queen Elizabeth. Long live Queen Elizabeth. May the Queen live forever.
You can turn it up a little bit for this final bit. Look at the planes. Oh, sorry, the two isn't in there. I thought it was. It's just ER. Which means Elizabeth Regina in Latin, Elizabeth Reigns. That is what's called the Imperial State Crown, if you ever go to London. Okay, let's have a break, and then when you come back, we'll look more closely about why it all collapsed And I'll show you how the United States is going through the same thing right now.